Give a man a fish and you feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish and you feed him for a lifetime. A quote similar to that one used to hang on the wall of the church office. It was written on butcher's paper in some scrawly handwriting, and I think it was green and red texture, and it was illustrated with a stick figure man holding a fishing rod. Does anyone else remember that? I'm getting some nods. Today, the topic that I am speaking about is being empowering. And when I was first given this topic, it was that quote and the picture of the stick figure man that first came to my mind. We as a church strongly believe that everyone who walks through these doors has something to learn, but also something to teach. To us, being empowering means that we're intentional about growth, the growth of ourselves and the growth of others around us. We want this to be a place where people can transform in a sustainable way, a place where you can learn how to grow so that you can continue to grow every day, wherever you are. As a church, we spend time and resources prioritizing you and equipping you with the skills and the knowledge and the understanding to become more like Jesus and more like yourself. So if you've missed a couple of weeks or you're new here or like me, you've spent a lot of time in the kids' playground recently, I just wanted to catch you up on where we are. We're in the middle of a series, or the end part of a series, about overflow distinctives. Overflow distinctives are the things that we as a church highly value and the things we think we do really well. They're the things that we prioritize in a way that other churches might not. And we're talking about these distinctives not from a place of pride or comparison. In the school holidays, we prefaced this whole series by talking about the church, and we talked about the church as a body, and as a bride and as a family. We believe that this church is part of a wider church body, a regional and national and global body of people who love Jesus and follow him. And our distinctives are the unique and excellent things that we do that we can use to contribute to that greater body, that we can use to build up the rest of that body and let Jesus be known throughout our city and our nation and the world. So one of those overflow distinctives, as I mentioned, is my topic today, being empowering. This is where we're going today. We are working in an inverted triangle from most abstract to most practical. At the end of today, I would like you to feel like you know what being empowering is. And I want you to leave here with a couple of practical tips on how you can be empowering here in our church and in your everyday life. So we're going to start with, where does being empowering come from? What are some of the theological concepts that underpin being empowering? The next thing we're going to do is talk about, what does it look like? What are some examples of being empowering here at Overflow? And finally, how do you be part of it? What's one or two things you can do before you leave today to be empowering? Does that sound okay? Okay, fabulous. Let's go. So we're going to start with that big abstract one. And we're going to start with one of the theological concepts that underpins being empowering. There are lots, but we're just going to do one. And it's known as the priesthood of all believers. Just want to clarify today that when I say the word priest, I know it has lots of connotations, but for the purpose of right now, when I say priest, I'm referring to the Old Testament priests in the Bible. I'm not talking about modern church leaders who go by the name priest. So if we journey right back to the beginning of the Bible, when Adam and Eve were exiled from Eden, they stopped walking and talking with God. They lost that special and sacred place where they could talk to him face to face. In the centuries after Eden, other sacred places were created for God to dwell in and for people to meet God in. Throughout the Old Testament, we read about these sacred places, and examples are called the tabernacle or the temple. Can you guys give me a thumbs up if you've heard those before? Understand where I'm at? Fabulous. Sorry, I'm a teacher. I really like feedback. So I will ask you questions and just make sure I'm getting feedback. So as well as having these sacred places like the temple and the tabernacle, God also appointed special people, sacred people called priests, whose role was to represent God to the people around them and to represent those people, the people of Israel, to God. They were the middleman. So there are a couple of ways that they did this representation gig, and they're up there on the slide behind me, but I just wanted to talk through what being an Old Testament priest looked and sounded like. So priests represented God to people by teaching the laws that we see in the first five books of the Bible. Those kind of laws we find in the Torah that we might not use anymore, but were really important to the people of Israel being holy and healthy. They also represented God to people by giving blessings on God's behalf and by providing judgments about spiritual, legal, and ethical matters. They represented the people of Israel to God by offering sacrifices on behalf of the people. Often these were animal sacrifices, things like birds or cows, depending on the situation or the finances of those people. They also worshipped God and they prayed for the people of Israel. But then, after many generations of this happening, some really good priests and some really corrupt priests, Jesus comes. And in a way that only Jesus can, he both fulfills the role of priest and changes it completely forever. Now we're going to watch a Bible Project video that explains how Jesus changed that role of priest. The reason I've chosen to do this is because, honestly, it explains it quicker than I could. So when you watch this video, it's about 5 minutes long, so bear with me, watch the video, and then at the end, can you just turn and talk to the person next to you and tell them what stood out for you? What did you learn?
The Bible introduces humanity as God's royal priests, ruling with God in Eden, a place full of life and abundance and God's blessing.
But humanity was deceived by evil and then exiled from Eden. And so humans forfeited their calling as the royal priesthood.
But God promised that one of their descendants would be an even better priest who will defeat evil and intervene on their behalf to restore the blessings of Eden.
This descendant would be a royal priest like Melchizedek that Abraham met in Jerusalem, and also like Moses and the priestly figure he saw on Mount Sinai. This descendant will also be like David and the priest king that David called my Lord in Psalm 110. And all of these figures lead us to Jesus, the ultimate royal priest who suffered and died for a failed humanity so that they could be restored to their original calling as royal priests.
About a month after the resurrection of Jesus, his disciples see him ascend into the skies.
Yeah, this was the fulfillment of Israel's hopes and of the story of Jesus. He was exalted into the heavenly temple of God's presence and installed there as the cosmic royal priest.
Now, Jesus also told his followers to wait for God's presence to come and guide them into the future.
And so during Pentecost, a festival in Jerusalem, God's Spirit comes down on them like they're each mini temples who are filled with God's presence.
Mini temples?
Yeah, just like God took up residence in the tabernacle and later the temple, now God dwells among the followers of Jesus and their bodies are the temple. The Apostle Peter, who was there that day, later put it this way. You all are living stones, built up as a spiritual house. You all are a royal priesthood.
So they are altogether God's temple.
And they're also the priests, reclaiming that lost calling that God gave humanity to represent him and to rule the world on his behalf. The Spirit is restoring the life and blessing of Eden to the people of Jesus.
But these people aren't priests. They're merchants and fishermen, soldiers and slaves, tax collectors and the poor. They work in the world, not in temples.
And yet, they talked and behaved as if they were priests. They believed Jesus was the cosmic royal priest, ruling all of heaven and earth as his temple, and they saw themselves as an extension of Jesus here on earth, that is, the body of the Messiah.
That's a beautiful image. but what does it actually look like?
Well, if you went to the temple in Jerusalem, you would hear the priestly choirs singing poetry that honored God and that told the story of his love. Music was a bridge between heaven and earth.
Ah, so the followers of Jesus started writing and singing new songs about Jesus as part of their priestly calling.
Right. Priests also surrendered everything over to God through their sacrifices. And so followers of Jesus started giving themselves their time and their money and energy to serve those in need. And they said, these are the sacrifices that bring pleasure to God.
Priests also intercede on behalf of others through blessings and prayers, advocating for the needs of everyone.
Yeah, this is why the Apostle Paul called on the Christians living in Rome to all together offer their bodies as one single living sacrifice.
A living sacrifice.
Yeah, Jesus offered his life in the ultimate act of love. And so they too were to surrender themselves to each other and to those who needed their help. This is the royal priesthood, Jesus style.
When people imitate Jesus, the royal priest, they become a new humanity, living in a way that reunites heaven and earth.
Exactly. And now you can see how the whole Bible is one unified story about a royal priestly humanity that lost its way.
But then how God promised to raise up a priest who would give his life to restore us.
And then how the stories of Abraham and Moses and David all point forward to a promised priest king.
And how this all led to Jesus, our great high priest, who suffered on our behalf to restore us to our calling.
And so this is why, on the final pages of the Bible, there's a vision of a renewed and reunited heaven and earth with humans serving and ruling as God's royal priests forever.
I was so excited to hear people talking pretty much all of that time, and I really hope that you learned something from the people you were talking with and that your knowledge was enriched through that conversation. As that video mentioned, through Jesus, the high priest, we have all become priests. And this idea is woven all throughout the New Testament, and it's woven through in the form of imagery, the imagery of priests and temples and sacrifices. So today we're just going to look at one passage in particular and go over some of the things that were talked about in the video. So the passage today is 1 Peter 2, verses 4 to 10. So feel free to bring it up or read along on the screen with me. As you come to him, the living stone, rejected by humans but chosen by God and precious to him, you also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For in the scripture it says, "See, I lay a stone in Zion, a chosen and precious cornerstone, and the one who trusts in him will never be put to shame. Now to you who believe, this stone is precious, but those who do not believe, the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, and a stone that causes people to stumble and a rock that makes them fall. They stumble because they disobey the message, which is also what they were destined for." Verse 9, "But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." That passage is pretty dense, so I just wanted to pull out four things that I think are significant to this conversation about being the priest. The first thing that is significant is in that first verse there, and it's that him, the living stone, is Jesus. The name links to the two quotes in the verses below. So when there's those passages that are kind of indented, they are quotes from Old Testament scripture. One of them is from Psalms and the other one is from Isaiah. They draw attention to the truth that Jesus is the messianic suffering servant that the Jewish prophets wrote about in the Old Testament and the Jewish people were waiting for with great anticipation. This part here and these quotes really frame it for the audience of the day that Christians' roles as priests comes within the power and the authority of Jesus, the royal priest, the Messiah, which the Jewish people have been waiting for such a long time. The second thing I wanted to point out is that we are being built into a spiritual house. This idea of a sacred place, because the temple was a sacred place, is also referenced down in this indented passage where it says Zion. Zion is a name in the Psalms used to refer to Jerusalem, a sacred place. God's presence is no longer contained in a building or a single space. This passage describes how we have all become the sacred place where God dwells. And I think it's really interesting to note that the image of building a temple from stones is one of an individual becoming a collective. We are individual temples, or the video put it, mini temples. We are mini temples who come together to build a unified collective temple that embodies the presence of God. Number three, we are being built into temples so that we can do the work of priests. One of the best things that Zach ever said to me is when you see a therefore, ask what it's there for. So I applied that knowledge and I saw the word to and I asked, why is it there? It actually links two concepts. That small word to makes a big difference. I'm referring to verse 5 here, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood. This indicates that the outwork of being unified temples is to work together as a priesthood. Collectively, we are the people who represent God to our world and who bring the needs and wants and hopes of our world to our God. As individual priests and as a priesthood who meets together, we get to perform those priestly roles of worship, intercession, teaching the people who don't know Jesus about him, of justice in our world and of offering sacrifices. And the fourth thing I wanted to point out is it says sacrifices. And for our modern Western worldview, that's really uncomfortable. I find that uncomfortable. Is that just me? No? Thanks for the feedback. Although Jesus's sacrifice was sufficient and complete, we're invited to continually sacrifice ourselves. It's one of those strange and beautiful tensions of the New Testament. As living sacrifices, we get to lay down the things that are not of God, and we get to undergo the costly process of transformation so we become more and more like him. Paul calls this the renewing of our mind. We get to choose unity with other members of the priesthood and the temple over social, political, or national boundaries. We get to pay the cost of being in community, even when it's awkward or messy or inconvenient, so that Jesus can get the healthy and effective and unified priesthood and temple that he paid for. So we're going to exit out of that deep dive. Thanks for bearing with me. Thanks for giving me feedback. What does being a priest look like here at Overflow? What does it mean to us now? To kind of structure this conversation, I wanted to talk about a phrase that you might have heard before. If you've been here for a little bit, it's likely you've heard the phrase, you are the ministers. Who's heard that? It's one of Chris's favourites. I've been here for almost 20 years, which is a funny thing to say. And that is one of the things that is ingrained in me, that this is a place where everyone is a minister. You are the ministers could also be expressed as you are the priests. And it's a phrase that is often used when we're being encouraged to pray for each other or prophesy for each other during a service. Through our unity, we're called to represent the goodness of God to the people around us through word, through sign, and through deed. As a spiritual house built of these tiny mini temples, we can all experience God's presence and we can all share God's presence. Because we're all priests, ministry, such as prayer or prophecy or healing, is not just the responsibility of our church leadership team. And although we honour the authority of church leaders and mature Christians, they don't control the wider congregation's access to God's power or presence. During our services, we're intentional about providing opportunities where all of us get to represent God to the people around us and where the people around, we get to represent those people to God. This can look like sharing testimonies, making time for discussion during the sermons that we can hear each other's thoughts and engage in reciprocal teaching. Opportunities for prophecy and prayer and healing ministry. It's also in these times that we get to conduct intercession and sacrifice. And if I'm honest, I'm going to tell you what this sacrifice looks like for me. On my best days, I absolutely love the opportunities for testimonies and prayer and group discussion. On an average day, it's a bit of a sacrifice for me. I get to surrender my attention, my assumptions, and sometimes my discomfort to be part of a priesthood that ministers to each other. And on my very, very worst days, I conveniently escape to the toilet during these times. And the reason I'm letting you guys know that is because I'm conscious that maybe for some of you here today, you're on your worst day and escaping to the toilet sounds convenient. And I just wanted to let you know that please don't hear this message as something that you need to do or something you need to try harder at. It's not about performance and it's not about perfection. It's about growing together as a priesthood, wherever we're at. Best day, escaping to the toilet day. We get to keep on providing opportunities for testimonies, discussions, and ministry, even when it's messy and even when we get it wrong, which we do. Because through practice, we build our capacity to minister. Although there's times for rest and being ministered to, we could call this being given a fish. We also want you to grow in your capacity to minister to others, not just receive ministry, which could be called like teaching a man to fish. We believe that we have a strength in ministering to each other, and it's something we've worked for over a long time, and it's something we want to share with the wider global regional church body. Because it's so important to us, I want to move on to the very tip of my triangle now and give you some practical tips on what ministering well looks like in this house. And before I do that, I just really want to preface that I am saying these things because I think you guys are already amazing at it. Please don't hear this as condescending. Please hear this as these are things that I have learnt from being in this house and doing this with you. And the reason that we are revisiting these things is because it is something that we want to invest in and we want to do with excellence. Here's my list of when we're ministering to each other, things I'd encourage and things I would avoid. They are a list of generalizations. They won't apply to every situation, but I think on a whole, they're generally true. So here are some things I would encourage. I would encourage that when you are ministering to somebody either in this house or in the wider community, that you ask for permission and for direction. It's best to avoid assumptions. When somebody comes to you for ministry or you would like to minister to them, a great phrase to use is, what would you like to receive today? Or would you mind if? When we ask permission, it makes people feel safe. Particularly if we're laying on hands, it's a really great idea to just say, do you mind if I put my hand on you? And if somebody says no, please respect that. Second thing is to keep confidentiality. Again, it makes people feel safe. I would always endeavor to make sure that when you are praying with someone or you're ministering with someone, that you keep that space confidential and you even explicitly tell them, I'm not going to repeat this. Same goes for if you think of an amazing story of someone else who had that breakthrough or that healing, please don't share it in that moment unless you have their permission, because we want to make sure we've got confidentiality on both sides to ensure safety. The next thing I would do is focus on God's goodness and power in every moment. Sometimes when we're talking to people and we're praying for people or we're giving words of prophecy, people have really bad stuff going on in their lives. And that's heartbreaking. And I don't want to be callous, but one of the best things we can do in that moment is show empathy and focus on God's goodness. Rather than getting bogged down in what's wrong or focusing on the demonic activity or the negative things that are going on, one of the best things we can do is call out who God is, shifting the focus to God and how good he is and the solutions he might have. Generally, works a lot better than getting bogged down in the negative, because people already know about their rubbish. People need to be reminded of God's goodness and the hope that he has for them. One of my other top tips is to let mystery draw you into God. Sometimes when we're ministering to people, we encounter situations that we don't understand. We encounter situations where God's goodness is not immediately obvious, or the circumstance seems to contradict what we know about God and we know about our world. And those times are heartbreaking and they're real. If you encounter that, I would encourage you to draw closer to God. Instead of creating theology around a circumstance and saying, because this happened, God must, shift it the other way. Say to God, I don't understand this, but because you are good or because you are powerful, this situation must. Does that make sense? Are you tracking with me? Yeah. The next thing I would encourage is asking before you give advice. One of my favorite phrases is, would you like to hear my thoughts on this? And if someone says no, I don't tell them. Because the thing about advice is, unless you've got relationship with someone, or unless you've been invited to share it, advice can come out as judgment, even though we're not intending it to. It can sound like, well, here's how I would have dealt with this situation better than you. So, as a general rule, I would avoid giving advice, particularly unwanted or sneaky advice. Sneaky advice is a term that I am borrowing from Jim. And he defines sneaky advice as when you slip advice into a prayer for someone, like, dear God, can you please help Sarah to understand that she shouldn't wear this color because it's not flattering for her on stage. Like, if someone prayed that, I would stop focusing on God and I would start being self-conscious about what I was wearing. It's not helpful. It's sneaky advice. Don't do it. And the last thing that I would encourage you to do is to follow up if you're able and if you're capable. People feel loved when we hear them on a Sunday morning and we spend some time following up the following week or the next fortnight, or we send them a message a couple of days later. People feel loved. So those are just a couple of practical things that I would advocate that you do and you don't do, both in your ministry here within our church. And if you get the opportunity to minister in your community and in your world. So where we're going to land today is we are going to spend some time with an invitation to ministry. That ministry can look like praying for someone. It can look like giving a prophetic word. It can look like worshiping with someone or talking with them and giving them a word of encouragement. I'm not going to put it on rails. But we're going to have a time for ministry. And during that time, I would encourage you to try and implement some of this stuff. It's okay if you don't get it right, if it's not perfect. We're learning together. This is a distinctive. This is something we practice all the time, that we revisit regularly. So I'm going to hand over to Jim, and he's just going to help facilitate that moment so that we can practice some of this stuff.
One of the biggest barriers to people ministering to each other, biggest barriers to people being the priesthood, tends to be the feeling of, I don't have anything to offer. Here's the truth. It's impossible for you to pray and for nothing to happen. We have a good and big God. So even if you're not feeling it, even if you're like, I don't have a lot of faith today or whatever, he's a good God and you can release his goodness into a situation just by praying. So I'm just going to get everyone to take a moment and just ask the Lord, is there someone you're inviting me to pray for this morning? Maybe someone popped into your mind. Maybe just a lot of fear and intimidation popped into your mind, which might be an invitation to push through that. So I'm going to invite Joe and Brenton back up here. We're going to have a time of worship. And during this time of worship, I'd invite you to be open to going and praying for someone. There's totally no pressure. Like if you just want to worship the Lord, do that. But there is an opportunity for us to be the priesthood together. And the beautiful thing is, like, we need to be ministering to each other in order to be the healthiest church possible. Like, we need all the gifts at work to be a healthy body. So we need what everyone brings, everyone's gift, everyone's revelation, what everyone is. We need that to be the healthiest church that we can be. So this is actually, like, this is very important because this is how we be healthy together. And often our breakthrough comes through community. It comes through each other. So we're going to worship, and I would encourage you to minister to each other, to use that question like, hey, would you like me to pray for you? Is there anything I can pray for you for?